having considered this awesome God who is our refuge, who fights our battles for us, who has accomplished redemption on our behalf, now we get to hear from this God from his word and consider what it means as his people to reflect his character and to live as his covenant people. And so that's our intention today. We're going to do that through Micah chapter 6. You might want to have a hand in Isaiah as well. Micah is often considered to be, well, not often, sometimes considered to be Isaiah light, where you get a lot of the concerns that Isaiah has, some of the story and the things that Isaiah is communicating to his people in Micah, condensed into just these, you know, seven chapters. There's a couple passages in Isaiah that flesh out a little bit more some of what we'll be looking at in Micah 6 today. So you might want to keep your hand in Isaiah. I might look at chapter 1 a little bit, and maybe also Isaiah chapter 58 as well, too. So if you want to have a bookmark in Isaiah 58, go for it. If not, you can just follow along when we read that. It's a good passage of scripture that we're on here today. Andrew Plasecki was telling me when we were meeting for prayer back there that this is probably the one passage that most people maybe have a little bit of Micah 6:8 memorized, right? So it's a fun thing to be able to preach the one really familiar passage of Micah. I'll let you know though, it's also a potentially dangerous thing to do as well too, because it is one of the striking passages in the book. For me, it's one that I have anticipated preaching through, and it's one that, so in a sense, has been sort of just stewing in the mind and the heart, you know, over the past several weeks as we've been going. So there's all this sort of material that's been building up and is ready to come out. But we're going to hopefully keep this in good timing today. Again, what does it matter? And who wants to watch another Super Bowl that the Patriots are in anyway? So if we go a little over, that's okay. But we're going to try to keep on schedule. Well, let's stand together. Let's read Micah 6. I'm going to read verses 1 down through verse 8 this morning. Micah writes to God's people. It says, "Hear what the Lord says. Arise, plead your case before the mountains, and let the hills hear your voice. Hear, you mountains, the indictment of the Lord, and you enduring foundations of the earth. For the Lord has an indictment against his people, and he will contend with Israel. Oh, my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Answer me. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery. And I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. Oh, my people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, devised, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him, and what happened from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. Well, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I bring before him burnt offerings? With calves? Shall I come with calves a year old? Or will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God." This is the reading of God's word to us this morning, and we pray that his Spirit would give us eyes to see and ears to hear, and hearts that are willing to submit ourselves to it in faith. So I've mentioned here before, I'm pretty sure, that one thing I'm always fascinated by is the rapid expansion of the ancient church in the Roman Empire. I think some historians say that it grew at a rate of about 40% per decade. In a relatively short span of time, this, you know, fledgling ragtag group of, you know, Christ followers quickly bloomed into over 6 million people and to compose 1/10 of the whole Roman Empire in that day. And what's particularly fascinating about that is some of the conditions that led into that. Like, for instance, there was no cultural incentive, right, to convert to Christianity. In many places throughout the Roman Empire, Christianity was an illegal religion. It was scorned by prominent people in your cities or your communities. It was often persecuted by people who were in power. At times, there were empire-wide persecutions of Christians. When you convert to Christianity, you would often lose your social standing. You might lose your job. You might lose your family, right? So there's no real incentive culturally to convert to Christianity. You might even lose your life, for that matter. You know, and then the other thing, here's where it gets really interesting, is we don't really have a whole lot of record of the church back then going out and like preaching on the streets. Right? You didn't do that because it was very dangerous to do that. You see what happens in the book of Acts when, you know, the apostles are out there preaching on the streets. We don't have any evidence or testimony of, I don't know, church-wide outreach campaigns. You know, they're not having kids' fairs out in the parking lot, you know, trying to draw the neighborhoods to come in. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but they're not. We don't have any record of them doing that. We don't even have any record, really, of, you know, like when you read the ancient church fathers or you read the ancient church leaders as they're writing to their people, you don't see them exhorting their people to share their faith with their neighbors or with their relatives. You're not getting these big calls to evangelism either in the church fathers or, well, I might question you, maybe even in the New Testament itself, you don't get a whole lot of this exhortation. Hey, you got to be going out there and sharing your faith. So it's just a very curious thing. How in the world did this church explode on the scenes when it was hazardous to do so? And we don't have a whole lot of outreach campaigns going on. We don't have fancy worship services taking place. People are meeting in secret in people's homes, and they often would have here's the interesting thing too, you often had bouncers sort of outside the doors and you weren't allowed into these worship services in certain places unless you had been baptized because, you know, they were worried about spies coming in, infiltrating and going and reporting back and, you know, and all this stuff. And there was a pretty hefty process through which you had to go through it in order to become baptized. It was often a year-long catechesis program, right? So it was not easy to just convert to Christianity either. So again, how in the world does this church explode onto the scene? Well, you can read historians, sociologists on that, both Christian ones and secular ones, and it's a curious question for all of them. And they'll give you a variety of different answers. But one thing that most of them will eventually get around to, coming back to, is they'll say that the ancient church, it held out before a watching community, a watching neighborhoods, a very radically different way to do life. And it was intriguing. And it was somewhat attractive to the community outside. In particular, what was intriguing or what was fascinating or what was very radical is the way that the ancient church cared for both one another and the neighbors around them. The church was known for how they sacrificially gave of themselves to care for the poor. Ancient church was known for the ways they would go out and nurse the sick, often at times at great risk to themselves, right? They would go into disease-ridden sections of the city to find people who needed care, and they would put themselves in those contagious zones in harm's way so that they could show care to those who were sick. This is stuff you didn't really do back then. Ancient church was known for the dignity that they showed to people who were often overlooked, disregarded, or considered as weak or insignificant. And again, this was all a very radical way to go at life, and it was intriguing to people. They were asked, they were curious about it. And here's the thing, even more than that, they were curious about what kind of God do you serve? What kind of God do you worship such that you are compelled to live this very different way of life? You remember last week when we started last week, the sort of the opening question I was asking was, What is the impact that the church has in the midst of the communities, the neighborhoods that we have been sent to? It's a question I think we should always be asking. What kind of presence, what kind of impact do we have in the places that we are sent? And we push that even further to say, how might we have more of an inspiring presence? You know, and you might remember too, you know, we're asking that question in a particular time where, you know, in the previous week, we were just particularly heartbroken of some of the decisions that we saw, you know, like taking place up in the state of New York and things. And so we're maybe asking this question, how, you know, we know how to speak out against things we don't like. We know how to cast our votes in certain ways to see things happen on the ground that we might see. But how might we live as a people in a way that has this seasoning effect in the culture that is really inspiring to produce change on that cultural level? That's part of the reason I get interested in the ancient church, because they managed to pull that off. And they're a good example of that we could look at for some evidence or some demonstration of that. And here's how this connects with this passage. I think what you find in this passage in Micah 6, in one way, is a nice summary of, you could argue, really the whole Old Testament or even the whole Bible's maybe some of that answer to that question too, of how might you go about living in such a way that reflects me in a way that is inspiring, that is seasoning, that is convicting in the culture that you are part of. Or in other words, I think you find in Micah 6 some of the motivation or some of what inspired the ancient church, and what I'm hoping will inspire us as well today too. So that's a little bit where we're going. Let's dive in and give a look at that. The passage, actually, it's got a very specific form. This passage that we're looking at, it's a courtroom drama. I don't know if you, I grew up like watching, I was probably a weird kid who liked watching courtroom shows. I grew up watching Matlock reruns. And I always wanted to be a lawyer, actually, and my mom was one perpetually trying to talk me out of it. I don't know why, but so I get interested in this passage. We have a few passages like this in the Prophets, in the Psalms, Deuteronomy, that fall under this form of a sort of a covenant lawsuit, right? God and his people exist in this covenant relationship or a covenant arrangement where they made promises to one another to be a certain thing to one another. And one party in that covenant is letting go of their responsibilities. And so what you have in the Prophets and some of the Psalms are these covenant lawsuits where God is prosecuting a case against his people. All right? And so in these passages, you have a summons of the jury. And then you have the statement of the case. And then maybe you have a little bit of a rebuttal. And then you have some kind of a charge on the end of, okay, here's where you go from here. All right. And that's sort of the structure of our text. You see there in the beginning, verse 2, "Hear you mountains, the indictment of the Lord." The jury here is the mountains or the enduring foundations of the earth. For the Lord has an indictment against his people. He will contend with Israel. And that aspect of God having an indictment against his people, you pick up in the text, it's something of a sad thing. It's a weighty thing. In verse 3, "Oh, my people." Or in verse 5, again, "Oh, my people." Right? There's a heaviness to this, that God is having to bring suit against his own beloved people. So verse 3, here's where it might be helpful to just remember where we've come so far in Micah. Why is this suit coming, right? You remember Israel's doing a lot of different things. They're flirting with other gods because they think there's all sorts of tangible benefits that come from flirting with these other gods. And the other thing that's going on, there's all just sort of rampant injustice that's taking place in their community. Right? You've got the strong and the mighty who have found a way to oppress the weak and the poor and take their possessions from them. And then they found a way to buy off the rulers and the judges and even the prophets so that they would endorse their unjust actions and behaviors. Or if you were look at Mike, again, Isaiah, who expands these courtroom scenes, he would say it this way in his courtroom drama, how the faithful city has become a whore. She who was once full of justice, righteousness lodged in her, has now become a city of murderers. Silver has become dross. Her princes are rebels, companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe, runs after gifts, and they do not bring justice to the fatherless. And the widow's cause does not come to them. Okay, so this is part of the issue that's going on here. And in verse 3 of our passage here in Micah, God begins to make his own case. And he starts by saying, hey, what in the world have I done to you? How have I wearied you such that you neglect this covenant relationship that we have? Was it when I brought you up out of Egypt? You remember that, right? You remember how you were slaves pounding clay and straw into bricks for Pharaoh to use in his palaces, or out digging irrigation trenches in the baking Egyptian sun for these new cities that Pharaoh wanted to build. Right? And you remember how when you were crying out in oppression and pain, how I looked at you with compassion and I came and I ransomed you and I delivered you from that. Or was it when you were going through the wilderness, how I provided leaders for you to care for you? I provided Aaron and I provided Moses and I provided Miriam to be with you and to lead you through that. Or was it, hey, you remember how, you know, when you neared the end of your wilderness journey, as you were about to cross into the promised land, how the king of Moab and the elders of Midian all got together and conspired about how we can, you know, stop the Israelites from entering into and taking the promised land, and how they made this, they went after Balaam to try to get him to pronounce curses on you, but I instead moved in a powerful way and you received blessing upon blessing. Or is it that, do you remember when, what happened between Shittim and Gilgal? Come on, Ray, what lies between Shittim and Gilgal? Oh, might have stumped them. You got the Jordan River in between the two, right? So as they're coming up to the edge of the promised land to go in to take possession, well, they got this mighty river in front of them. And you remember how when the ark of the Lord was carried down, and when the people came who were carrying it and just dipped their toes in the water, I caused the water to stop and the dry land to appear, and you were able to walk across the dry land and take possession there in Gilgal of this land that I had in store for you, right? Have you forgotten all of this? All right, so that's verses 3 and 4, 5. And then in verse 6, you begin to get a little bit of the response of God's people. They say, okay, well, essentially, I'm going to paraphrase it here. Essentially, they say, okay, so what do you want? All right, well, how can we make this right? How can we come back before you? Do you want burnt offerings? Verse 6, do you want calves? Only a year old? Or verse 7, do you want rams? We'll bring 1,000 of them for you. Or maybe do you want oil, like some of the other gods? They like, you know, their fancy oils. We'll bring you 10,000 rivers of oil. It's kind of an interesting response when you think about it. Because what the Israelites are not saying, they're not here saying, yeah, we're kind of done with you. And that's not what they're saying. They're saying, okay, well, you know, how do we make this right? We want this covenant relationship with you. So do you want calves? Do you want the rams? Do you want the rivers of oil? You know, or if you go back and you look in that passage in Isaiah 58 that I mentioned, he expands on this, and the prophet is called to cry out against the Lord, against God's people in verses 1. And then in verse 2, he expands on it and he goes so far as to say this, yet they seek me daily, my people. And my people, they delight to know my ways, as if they were a nation that did righteous things. And then in verse 3, you have the sort of the response of the people there. This is Isaiah 58 again, where they say, and why have we fasted? And you seem to not take notice. Why am I going without my bacon and eggs or my hamburgers or my chocolate cake? Why am I fasting and going through the sacrificial fasting if you're not even taking notice of that? See, what's going on here? This is interesting. It's not that the Israelites have become atheists. Nobody was really atheist back then. So it's not that the Israelites are saying, oh, yeah, okay, God, yes. Well, we realize you've done some pretty great things for us in the past, but yeah, I'm sorry, we're just kind of done with that. We've found these kind of sexy new gods out here that give us all sorts of even better things as we kind of flirt with them a little bit. So thanks, but we're moving on. Can we just be friends? Right? They don't even have them saying that. No, they're saying, okay, well, what do you want? I'll bring rams. I'll bring calves. I'll bring rivers of oil. I'm fasting. I'm coming to worship services. I'm wanting to know of you, right? All this stuff. So you go back into that Isaiah 58, and here's the telling thing. He says in verse 3, here's the deal. Behold, in the day of your fast, at the end of the day, you seek your own pleasure, and you oppress all your workers. Behold, you fast only so that you can quarrel and fight and hit with a wicked fist, go about all your unjust ways. See, it's a kind of a nuanced thing here that the prophets are poking at. They're saying, yeah, you bring your sacrifices. Yeah, you come to your worship services. Yeah, you inquire about me and you pursue me and you delight to know me and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, see, you're wanting to live your own life however you want to live it on your terms and ways that you think suits you best. And here's the thing. You're doing all this almost to buy me off. You're doing this, you're bringing your sacrifices, coming to the worship services, engaging in the religious activities, doing your fast, so that I will look with favor upon you and all these messed up things that you are doing in your life. You're treating me as one of those kings and judges and prophets, right, that you pay off and you slip the money in the back pocket so you can conduct your lives and behavior however you want, and they will endorse you because you've made them happy. That's how you're treating me. You're living your life on your own terms, but you come and you do all this religious stuff so that I'll look upon that with favor or whatever. All right, do you see that distinction? That's really important. Important response that's going on here. You get it most, perhaps most vividly. Well, or here's the other, here's the irony of it all. Or not, maybe not irony is not the word, but the thing that the Israelites are missing is that, you know, you go back to that when God ransomed them from Egypt, and he provided the leaders for them, and he delivered them from the king of Moab, and he delivered them into the promised land of Gilgal, and all this stuff. It wasn't because the Israelites had managed to perform enough religious ceremonies or acquire enough stuff to merit this favor of God, right? Right, when they were slaves in Egypt, it wasn't because they were all of a sudden the most noble or the most righteous people that God decided, okay, I'm going to go rescue those people. No, it was only because he looked at them with compassion and said, it is my desire. I've heard your cries, and it is my desire to come to your aid and to deliver you. And so the irony now is that they think, okay, here's what we can do. We can buy off God's pleasure. I'll bring the rams, and I'll bring the goats, and I'll bring the rivers of oil, and we'll be okay. Or most vividly, or most wretchedly, they even go so far as to say, verse 7, shall I give you my firstborn for my transgression? Shall I sacrifice my own child for you? Someone say, who in the world told you to sacrifice? Why in the world would you think that I would want your children? That's what that detestable god Moloch does. And see, you're thinking that you can buy me off the way you buy off their favors. And that's not what this is about. That's not what this covenant relationship is about. You know that. Here, verse 8, finally. Here is what it is that I have told you. Here is what it is, what is good. Another way to understand that word good, what is covenantally right. Here is what it means to live in this covenant relationship, to live as my people. Oh, sorry. It's a threefold thing, right? Those of you that have memorized it, you should know it. do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Let's talk about it. Do justice. Right, we've said from the beginning, as we've been working through Micah, justice is this highly repeated word throughout the book. Micah's talking about the injustice that's going on. He's urging his people to pursue justice. And we can't go back all over that, but we talked about what justice is, right? And at the basic sense, it is giving to people what they are due. And you can think of that in a negative way, like in a criminal way, right? If you do the crime, you are due to do the time, right? So you get what you pay for, you get what you earn. Okay, but there's the positive aspect to this too, that you give to people what they are due by virtue of being God's treasured people, people created in His image, people who God desires to live into the life that He created them for. So if you see them undergoing oppression, well, doing justice means you seek to relieve that oppression, because people are due a life that is free of oppression, a life that is free to live in faithful service to God without the fear of persecution or harm or whatever. Okay, but in the prophets, in the Old Testament, justice is bigger than that even. When you see people who, because of whatever circumstances might be going on in life, maybe they just had a rough year in their crops, or maybe they've lost a husband or a spouse or a father, and it's very difficult for them to live into the life that God has created for them to enjoy. Well, justice means you go to them and you do what you can to help them receive what they are due by virtue of being His beloved people, created in His image. One commentator put it, to do justice means you have this bent for social shalom, or social wholeness, or social well-being. Or another very, Bruce Waltke, he's one of the most respected conservative evangelical commentators on the Old Testament, has some connections with the BFC, doesn't he, Pastor Taylor? Yeah, you can explain that later. But he describes justice, and in particular righteousness, in this way. He says the two terms are related. And when you think righteousness in the Old Testament, don't necessarily think the way Paul talks about it. That's a whole separate conversation. But in the Old Testament, Bruce Waltke, conservative, respected evangelical scholar in the Old Testament, says this. Righteousness is a willingness to disadvantage self for the sake of the community. And think about that. And unrighteousness is the willingness to disadvantage the community for the sake of the self. You see this again in that Isaiah chapter, where in verse 6, you know, God responds to the people and they're moaning about their fast. And He says, is not this the fast that I desire? Not that one that you do so you can get your own pleasure. Is not this the fast that I desire? First, to loose the bonds of wickedness, and to undo the straps of the yoke, and to let the oppressed go free, right? But then is it not also to share your bread with the hungry, and to bring the homeless poor into your house? Or when you see the naked, to cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh and blood? Right? This is that picture of justice and righteousness that shines throughout the prophets and the whole Old Testament. And here's where it would be important to remember, it's such a deep topic, but what you find in the Old Testament is God coming to His people and saying, and guys, don't forget. Remember who you were when I came to you. Remember, you were slaves. You were the poor and the weak, and you had nothing. You were the oppressed. Right? Who lived at the whim of Pharaoh. You were the unwanted. Right? Who had no home, who had no family, right? And I came to you because it was my good desire to show compassion to you, and I set you free, and I gave you a land, and I gave you all of this rich blessing. And so here's the point. What does it mean to be my covenant people? Well, you reflect who I am. And you live out who I am. And I am a God who delights to do right by those who are in need. the poor, the oppressed. And so what does it mean to be my people? Well, you do justice. This is why when you get in the New Testament, you get guys like James, who says religion that is pure and undefiled before the Father is what? To visit the widows and the orphans in their time of distress, and to keep yourself unstained from the world. To look out for those who are in need, who are broken, who are weak, and to visit them in their time of distress, and to make sure you keep yourself unstained from the idols and the passions and the drives that animate the culture all around you. And there's so many references we could look at in the Old Testament. The one that perhaps is always shockingly convicting is when Jesus says in Matthew 25, I'm looking at you, Ray, where he talks about the day when he's going to return, and he's going to sort of divide the sheep and the goats. He's going to separate his people from the not his people. And he's going to say to his people on the right, come and receive the promised inheritance of the Father. For when I was naked, you clothed me. And when I was hungry, you fed me. And when I was poor and sick, you cared for me. And they're going to say, well, Lord, when did we ever see you like that? And he says, then what? Whenever you do this to the least of these, my brethren, you're doing it unto me. Right? So do justice. Love mercy. Similar concept. Again, Bruce Waltke, he describes that word. He says this word occurs commonly in a context in the Old Testament where one of the parties finds himself in a weaker situation and is utterly dependent upon the stronger party to meet his need. The stronger party accepts freely the responsibility of providing deliverance and protection to the one in need. This is what mercy is. You look for those who are in need, and out of a position of strength or of having resources, you take those and you invest those in one who are utterly dependent on somebody to show them care. And again, the call is here to love mercy, which implies that you recognize how much mercy has been shown to you, right? Again, you were slaves or you were nothing, and God came to you in your time of need. And so it's to be overwhelmed and in love with the mercy that God has shown to you, such that then it would be your desire to live that kind of mercy as well. I'm watching my time, so I gotta move through these here quickly. So do justice, love mercy, and again, walk humbly with your God. Right? Remember that this God that you walk with is the creator of heaven and earth, Lord of heaven and earth, as we sang. Right? The one who fashioned the stars and the planets, flung them into place, who with his word put together the mountains and the valleys and the streams and the oceans, and who with his breath gave life to all living things. This is the God you walk with. Humble yourself, O man. And I think part of that humility is too, and remember that all these blessings that you've received, all the mercy, all the care that has been shown to you, again, it's not because you were somehow mighty and worthy of it, because you were the type of people that God would want to show his mercy to. Well, you were, but it's not because of just who you are, it's because of his mercy and his compassion. Not because of necessarily who you are that has earned that. Well, so walk humbly. I think this is certainly one major issue in our broader culture's way that we think about God, right? There's not a whole lot of, I don't detect, a whole lot of humility in the way as a culture we think about God and our relationship with him. I think more of the trend in a broader culture is when we think about God, we almost think of ourselves, dare we say, almost like on unequals. But to be human is to be godlike. To be human is to have that spark of divinity within you, and so you're almost on par with God. And by virtue of that standing, you are entitled to God, working in your favor or working in your quarter or being, like that genie for you who just provides for you and, does all this stuff. Instead of in humility, recognizing who this God is and that only reason we have anything from him is because of his compassion. And see, here's the thing. When that dynamic of our relationship with God, the vertical dynamic, gets out of whack, this one will get out of whack too. when we are not walking humbly with God, and we maybe think that our agenda is on par with God's agenda, and we think that we are entitled from God his graciousness and his benefits and all these things to us, well, then that's also going to affect the way we treat other people. We're going to think that our agenda reigns supreme, and we are entitled from others just whatever suits our agenda, whatever. It's that humility, recognizing all that we have on account of God's mercy and compassion, that leads us to be enamored with that, to love it, and to be willing to, or maybe not see our own agenda so much and see the needs of others and have this desire to step in it with the love and compassion of God on their behalf. At any rate, hopefully I'm painting for you the big picture here. I don't want to get too lost in the details. The big picture here is, hey, this is not about bulls and lambs and fasts and religious ceremonies and all this stuff. This is about you've entered in a covenant relationship with me, a God who loves justice, a God who shows mercy and compassion. And so my desire is that my people will reflect that. My people will be like me, and you will shine that out in the places that you are apart. So I've shown you what is good. I've shown you what is right. Do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with me. It's a great summary of some of the prophets' concerns, maybe some of the great summary of how the Old Testament would talk about how what it looks like to live out this covenant relationship with God. Another great summary could be the way Jesus describes it when he just sums up the whole law by saying, here's what the law is. You love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You don't reserve some of your heart for these other gods out there. And you love your neighbor as yourself. Same passion, energy with which you care for yourself and your needs, you look to your neighbor and you love them the same way. And again, tied into where we started, this is some of the stuff that is animating and motivating the early church, right? They have been compelled by this controlling vision of who Christ is. They are convinced that Christ is raised from the dead, is seated on the throne, and so now to be his people is to be like him and to live that out. And so it's to go and to have compassion and mercy upon the poor, show care for the sick, show dignity to those who are overlooked. And again, they did it in such a way that it was radical and it was stark, and the outside world saw it and they said, what kind of life is this? And again, even more, here's to the point, what kind of God is this that you worship that leads you to live in this way? We mentioned last week part of the motivation to asking these questions, again, was the decision that took place up in New York about making it legal to abort babies all the way up to the very end, last trimester, and how that just breaks the heart of people who both are skeptical that it's only in the name of the woman's health and just have this view life as beautiful and sacred. And in the ancient church, they were passionate about this too. In the ancient church, abortion was maybe even more rampant than it is here today. I don't know for sure about that, but it was certainly a regular practice, oftentimes an encouraged practice. Poor people would do it because they couldn't care for the child. Rich people would do it. Rich women would do it because they had engaged in illicit sexual behavior, but they didn't want to be bound to share their resources with the father, and so they would abort the baby, so they weren't tied into that relationship. Sort of barbaric ways of going about abortion. But then here's the other thing. Here's even more despicable back then, is that it didn't stop at birth. That even in those early months, you could still back out and you could do what was called leave the baby out to exposure. You could leave the baby out in the elements. Maybe somebody would come by and take it. Or if you didn't want it, you just leave the baby to exposure and the cold elements or the animals or whatever would kill the baby and you were not liable. And this was perfectly okay and oftentimes encouraged by guys like Plato and Aristotle and the philosophical thinkers. You can go back and look at this. And so you would oftentimes find babies in the sewers, or you would find living babies out in the trash heaps outside of town. And so the Christians, because of their love for life and their recognition of the beauty and the sacredness of life, they would be out scouring the sewers and scouring the trash heaps, finding these babies and raising them as their own. giving their whole lives and their homes and whatever resources they had to bring these children in and to care for them. And the outside world was watching all this, seeing the dignity that they showed to the unwanted and the neglected. And that's what began to change literally a culture. Again, it wasn't their words. It wasn't their way they engaged in politics. Jesus and the apostles, they never talked about these detestable practices that are going on and the Roman Empire is allowing. But they encouraged them to live in a way that reflected who God was. And as they did that passionately, the culture saw it. They were intrigued. They were pricked by it. And by the grace and the power of the Spirit, that culture was changed. And so that's just, that's always my desire for our church, for the church in America, that we would live in such a way that would have that same effect. My dream would be that when the surrounding culture sees our church, that maybe someday they would say, you know what? There is a pro-life church. And they may or may not be talking about abortion. There's a church that sees the beauty and the sacredness of life and invests themselves in that life. And wow, look at that. There's a church that cares for the life of the child, the weakest among them, the child that is not yet even born yet, that care and can fend for themselves. Or there's a church that cares that a third of those children that are born are going to be born into poverty in the United States, at least. And there's a church that cares that, you know, the number one reason, not drugs, not abuse, not violence, the number one reason that children get taken into statewide care is because of poverty, because the family doesn't have the resources to have a working refrigerator or heat in the wintertime or transportation to get them to doctor's visits, right? So there's a church that cares about that. Or there's a church that cares not just for the child, but cares for the single mother who has to figure out a way to care for these children. And along the way, not slip into, I don't know, alcohol or drugs as just a means of coping with the pressures of life. There's a church that cares for the neglected and the poor and the downtrodden throughout all of life, that cares for the widows, the people who are forgotten and overlooked in society. There's a church that is pro-life. Phil Ryken was a pastor in Philadelphia for a while. Now he's the president of Wheaton College. And he says, perhaps our biggest opportunity to win minds and hearts is to speak and to act faithfully to address all pro-life issues. Working for a culture that values human life from conception to the grave and then on into eternity. The persuasive power of consistent pro-life convictions is cumulative. All right, well, I got to wrap this up. I should have said at the beginning, really my intention this morning with Micah A is just sort of open the door for conversations. Because we could certainly talk a whole lot more about justice and mercy and humility and how that ought to play out and pro-life issues and all that. I do want to say this, though. It is a real joy and a privilege to be a part of a church where I see a lot of this going on. I see a lot of people very passionate about showing care to families that are racked by addictions and children that suffer under that, and trying to see them get some solid footing under them so they can have a restored family life again one day. I see people whose hearts break for those who grieve or whose homes have been torn apart by unfaithfulness or divorce or whatever, and I see you spending yourself to care for them. I know that there are tons of individuals out there who are working in pregnancy centers and shelters and community organizations and with the local school districts and things like that. And it's great to be a part of that. And part of what I wanted to do this morning is just encourage you that those are not just, you know, little religious duties that you do as part of being Christian. No, that is kingdom life. That is the business of living in covenant relationship with the God who is merciful and compassionate and loves justice. So be encouraged. And if some of you are here and you're wondering, okay, how might I be more engaged? Well, there are some of those opportunities, you know, here. We're talking about some of those things behind the scenes. Or maybe I would even say to you, find someone else in the church who is spending themselves in that way. And if you can't join with them, maybe find a way to encourage them. Or help them out, or pick them up along the way when that gets difficult and that gets challenging, right? Let's do this together as a church. Maybe let's think about ways that we can expose some of that godlike, great godlike stuff that we're doing to a community so that maybe they can see some of not just our righteous deeds, but the God who inspires those things. Okay, this is the last thing, I promise. It has to be said. As we do these things, or as you engage these things, again, remember the context of the passage. We are not doing these things to earn God's favor. We are not doing these things to, to buy God off or to keep him happy with us or even to earn our way into his presence. That has already been granted to us by the blood and the resurrection of Christ. That's already yours. No, we do these things because that's who God is. Because God in his great mercy and his desire for justice has already shown that to you, has already reached down and grabbed you out of the depths, brought you into his family, ushered you into his presence, and given you this eternal blessing. So we do these things because that's who he is. And that's how we get to know him more, right? It's as we participate in who he is and what he's all about, we learn of him, we experience him as we are following Christ and living that out. So we do it because that's who he is, not because we want something from him per se, but this is what it means to be his children. So we do that, we lead our children in doing that so they can learn of who God is and experience this life of being his covenant people. And it's hard. It's challenging. It requires great measure of spirit-filled grace and life and power. And so, as we often close, we ask that God would enable us by his own grace and by his power to live effectively into the covenant life, live effectively as representations of him. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we ask. Amen.